A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Welcome to the Wild Tales podcast. I'm Jason Fox, and this series is all about adventure, resilience, and inspirational humans. The podcast is presented by The Book of Man and in partnership with Talisker, a single malt whiskey made by the sea. My guest today is Locksmith, or Lockie. Now, you'll know him as a member of the award-winning chart-topping band Rudimental, and you may also know him as one of the top contenders, in fact, one of the winners on the latest Celebrity SAS Who Dares Wins. In the podcast, we talk about growing up in Hackney, family, training, and where he got his resilience from. Now, we're still in lockdown, so this episode was again recorded remotely. Hopefully, we'll be back to normal soon. In the episode, we answer some questions that you've asked me on Instagram. I'm going to be sending a bottle of Talisker to the top question. Here we go. Hope you enjoy it. So, here we are, the man, the myth, the legend, Lockie, Locksmith. The one of the finishers of the very recent Celebrity SAS Who Dares Wins, and what an achievement that is, because it is brutal. But before we move on to that, because it will be part of the chat today, Lockie.
Yes, how mate.
Let's hear Locksmith's take on lockdown. How are you coping?
I don't know why you did that. I hope they can see your facial expressions as well. You're proper chuffed with yourself.
Oh, yeah. Good.
Lockdown. Lockdown's been all right with me. I've just approached it as another challenge, to be honest with you. There's been points where I've wanted to get out of the house and just fly away like a bird and be free. But at the same time, it is what it is. I think the biggest challenge of it all is the kids. How many kids are yours? Like every 5 minutes says, can I have a snack? Can I do this here? And you're trying to constantly find new and innovative ways of entertaining them and keeping them sort of like, you know, motivated and physically active. And it can be a bit jarring at times, as much as I love my 10-year-old as well, you know. But I think that's been the biggest challenge, to be honest with you.
Yeah, thing is, it's like normally they go to school, so there's a different environment, but there is no change in environment, is there?
I think that's the biggest problem as well, and the social interaction with their peers of their own age. So the mere fact that they've just got bundles of energy and nowhere to put it, it's just like, it's all on you. It's been a difficult one, but we're getting through it. Exercising, all the Joe Wicks stuff and that's helped. Getting outdoors on the bikes and stuff, that's great. But yeah, lockdown for me, it's been busier. I don't know about you, but me, it's like the whole music industry is doing my nutting at the minute, because they're all sitting on their hands, coming up with new bright ideas for you to do, and they're just throwing things at you left, right, and centre. I guess busy's good. I'm not complaining.
Mate, to be fair, I'm the same. I've been saying to people, I'm like, I can't wait for these, you know, whoever's to go back to work.
Trust me.
Once they go back, then it all sort of like everything does slip into place. And I know it's been a difficult time for many, many people, but normality is calling. It is calling.
Definitely. I'll never take it for granted again.
Yeah, big time. But whilst we're still on that, how have you found the homeschooling? There's a lot of people that they've struggled with it.
Yes, it's a difficult one. My little boy's mum, she's a teacher, so that helps. But at the same time, the kids don't like to listen to you. It's like when I try to do a bit of football training with my boy, it's like we constantly knock heads. And then as soon as his coach comes in and says exactly the same things I've been saying, he takes it on board and he's listening and this, that, and the other. So that kind of element of it is kind of difficult. I think the key here is not to make it too much of a structure, because if you do that, especially in the one environment that they're in, it's just going to be frustrating, not only for your kid, but for yourself. And that's what it's been like for us, to be honest. But yeah, he's been good. We do like 3 hours a day, no more. And then he gets a chance to do whatever he wants. But I've got things in place, Foxy. I'm not taking no prisoners there. I've got everything in my fridge labelled up with price tags on them, because there's a tuck shop in my ass. Because I know what he's like. He will just literally snack out every 5 minutes. So I've said to him, with the pocket money that he gets, he has to buy anything he wants in the fridge during the school hours. And so if he wants toast, that'll cost him 50 pence.
Mate, that's awesome.
That's
people need to be listening to this. I tell you what, you want to trademark that before this goes out.
All right, otherwise, trust me. Tuck shop.
You know what I mean?
I'm on the copyright already.
The locksmith tuck shop. Mate, I know you're into training, in a big way. What have you been doing? What's your regime? I know you've got a decent... I know, and I'm jealous of the fact that you've got a decent pull-up bar.
Yeah, no, I've got a wicked pull-up bar in the garden. That's one of my faves. Now, I'm more into sort of like the body-weighted exercises anyway, rather than just going in the gym and doing the heavy lifting and whatnot, which I do love as well, but it can be a bit monotonous. With the bodyweight stuff, you can take it anywhere, you know, that you don't just have to be restricted to a gym. And that's something I've been doing for years, especially being on tour with Rudimental. You're all over the world, and sometimes you're in these remote locations where you've got no facilities to train whatsoever. So you've got to make it up yourself. So that has come in handy whilst being in lockdown, the whole bodyweight experience.
Are the rest of the Rudimental crew, are they into the exercise?
It's so funny because I got asked a question the other day, how would the rest of the Rudimental boys react or cope with being on SAS Who Dares Wins? And I just couldn't stop laughing. The thought of them getting involved in anything like it is just hilarious. You got Kezzy, who we used to play football together. I think football, anything to do with football, he's fine. But when it comes outside of that, he really needs like a kick up the arse to do anything extra. Pears is a no-go. He's just, he's hippified and loves life. And then you've got a mayor who's just doesn't even know how to spell gym, let alone go to one. So it will be really interesting to see that happen.
Yeah, maybe that's the next thing. Right, mate, as with all of these, because we want people to go on a journey, your journey, what we're going to do now is we're going to sort of go right back to you giving us insight into your youth.
Yeah.
How was it growing up in the around the streets of Hackney?
East London, Hackney. What a place. Look, man, East London, Hackney made me who I am. You know, you've got so many cultures, so many things going on, so many different types of people that you're just exposed to so many different things. I've always said, coming from Hackney, growing up in Hackney, or even in a city, London, you can go anywhere else in the world and adapt. And that's been the case for me, especially going on tour around the world. Growing up in London, especially Hackney, was difficult on the streets and that. My home life was amazing. My mum did the best job possible as a single mother of three. Me and my two sisters. Just the streets were hard, man. It's just, I've seen some really horrible stuff, and I know you have, but
no, it's different. It's different.
Yeah,
it's on your own doorstep.
No, that's it, exactly. And you know, with my dad not being around, that kind of left me mentally in a no man's land, and I didn't really know who I was, and I was trying to find out who I was for a long time. And I've always said that football and music helped me massively. The fact that I didn't make it as a footballer, I blamed my dad for years, and that was a big issue for me. Falling back on music wasn't so bad because it got me to where I was today. And you got to think, like, if I didn't grow up in Hackney, I wouldn't have met the rest of the Rudimental boys. We've known each other since we were 5 years old, you know, and we shared the same interest. Football, music, you know, chasing the same girls, you name it, we did it. And I was convinced from an early age that I wanted to make it or whatever I wanted to do on my own. I felt like I needed to be self-sufficient, and that's what the streets taught me, is that you have to be able to look after yourself. I remember moving out when I was 16, and I ended up living in one of the worst estates in Hackney, probably in London. It was called Pembury Estate. And I remember it was horrible. I remember one day we woke up and we just woke up off the back of hearing some noises, and we were just like, what the hell's going on out here? And we went outside to see what the commotion was. And there was a kid lying on the ground, and he'd literally been stabbed to death. Like, just literally in our very eyes, a pool of blood. And I'm not trying to glamorize it, not trying to say that, you know, my situation is far worse than most, because I've been to some serious ghettos around the world, and it's like, you know, it's a lot worse. But waking up to see that, and then you're going around the corner, and I hate this memory. It stays in my head for such a, like, forever. It will stay in my head forever. I remember just walking down the alley, and on the same night, there was a baby lying on the floor, like a newborn baby. And like, you look at Hackney now and look how gentrified it is. People are probably listening to this and thinking, wait a minute, there's multi-million pound houses in that place. How was it like that? But that summed up how we were growing up, you know. And it wasn't on a daily occurrence. It was just, we were exposed to those kind of things. And I feel that gave me the grit and the determination, the desire to better myself.
Yeah, that's awesome. I mean, it's a good thing to come out of a bad sort of situation, really, isn't it? And a bad environment. But mate, yeah, just definitely. I should know this, and I don't. How old are you now?
I'm 33.
33. So, when you were like growing up on the streets, was it a lot like I remember me? I grew up in Luton, just a bit further north.
Right. And, yeah.
We were allowed to play out till God, you know. Like, yeah. God knows what time. You're just cutting around doing your own thing, really.
How mad is that? It's like, yeah. I believe that when I was growing up, it was a lot worse than it is now. Mm. Yet, when we were growing up, there was a sort of community spirit still installed. You know, you would be friends with your local newsagent owner. People would look out for one another. Or if something did happen, your mum would hear about it before you got home, kind of thing. Yeah. So with that said, we were allowed to stay out a lot longer and just get up to mischief. And luckily we came back all right. Now I think about it, like, you know, with my son being a parent now, do I feel comfortable leaving my son out there now? I don't know. I don't think I do. And I don't know why. I don't know. It's crazy.
I think even in this, the short time that we've sort of like grown up into, well, it's not that short a time, but you know, but I think there's like, especially in places like London, the population has just gone booms through the roof. And I think there's just a lot more people. So there's less of that community feel sometimes because there's just too many people.
No, definitely.
But So have you, leading on a little bit more, have you always been into music?
Yeah, always been into music, and obviously heavily passionate about it, especially to have done it this long. But growing up, my first love was football, and I think it's the same for so many young boys and girls out there. Growing up, you fall in love with football before you know what love is, you know, before my son was born, before my first love with my girlfriend or whatever. It was football. And that was my passion. And that kind of ran alongside, parallel to music, because music was always there. And with that said, the first time that I ever got into music was me begging my mum to buy me a pair of turntables. And, you know, my mum being a single mother, I've asked her for the top of the range decks at the time. They were like Technique 1210s. And I must have been about 12 years old. I had no right to have them.
I had a pair.
Did you have a pair, yeah?
Yeah, I was a bit older, but yeah.
This is what I'm saying, Foxy. Like, I had no right to have them. Like, you could have probably found those pair decks in any nightclub, any radio station. They were proper high-end. They were the ones to have.
Yeah.
I begged my mum to have them, and my birthday's on Christmas Day. It's like the shittest birthday ever. You've got to share it with the rest of the world. So I remember running upstairs Christmas Day, and my mum saying, look, I couldn't afford it. And like too right. She, it was expensive. It was ludicrous.
Yeah.
She said she couldn't afford it. So I was like, you know, a bit disappointed. I was being a bit spoiled. The one day of the year that was, you know, meant to be for me. Humbled on downstairs. You know, you want to do one of them cries where you cry in your pillow and all that nonsense. And then lo and behold, I looked in the chest of drawers and they were there. I don't know how she pulled it out of the bag. They were there.
Mate, that's awesome.
And ever since then, I never looked back. And I think she was, it was kind of one of those, yeah, keep you off the street for a little bit, because it did. And I kept scratching all her vinyls as well on her turntable. And that was doing her nutting. I'm talking like classics like Marvin Gaye records and Nia Baker and all that. And she used to get proper angry. So yeah, that was her way of, that was her investment in me. And, you know, I think it's paid off.
She just dug deep to save her own vinyl collection.
Yeah, exactly. exactly.
Awesome. Mate, the 1210s were brilliant. I have to say, it was actually Ollie Ollerton. They were his decks. And then when he decided, and then basically passed them over to me, he sort of like handed them on. And it was like, there was this ritual. Yes, it was these ritual that came across of all this vinyl and that. Oh, mate, it was terrible because I had the amp, I had the mixer and all this, and I ended up selling it all.
Oh, so no. What did Ollie say to that?
Well, mate, he had disappeared by this stage, but when we met back up, like, you know, not that long ago, he was like, mate, you still got the 1210s? And I'm like, mate, I've got a confession to make. So, yeah.
Oh, I love that. Love that.
Weirdly, we've both bought some new decks, this new digital sort of stuff.
No, recently. I've seen it. Good on you. So, love it.
Yeah, mate, it's good. It's good to get back into that. I mean, we're not very good, but it's a good crack. mate, did you have any sort of like, what was your inspiration in music? Do you have any like role models that you looked up to as a youngster?
Yeah. Definitely. There was a lot of role models. I used to look up to Ashley Waters a lot when I was younger growing up. And, you know, the funny thing is I wasn't really too heavily into sort of like So Solid, but I was heavily into sort of the whole culture of that vibe of being part of a team. And I always loved that, you know, coming from a footballing background and being in a band with my boys. I love the fact that you look after each other and you have someone's back. And I love the fact that So Solid had that. I love the Roll Deep from East London that consists of Wiley, at one point consists of Dizzy as well. A lot of my role models at that particular time were people of my own age, but they kind of accelerated a lot further in the music than I did at that particular moment. So they felt like they were older. And then you had the likes of, you know, when you cross the waters, the Dr. Dre's of the world, that kind of thing, and Busta Rhymes. And the thing is about Rudimental as well, our influences are so far and wide. If you listen to our albums, they're not genre specific. You know, it's like you've got drum and bass, you've got house, you've got a bit of R&B in there, and you just fuse all those flavors together off the back of listening to Lauryn Hill, Marvin Gaye, you know, and Earth, Wind and Fire. And then you just get Rudimental, if you like. And that's where our influences really come from.
Yeah, I like all the stuff that you've just been talking about. Where I grew up, we used to, for some reason, ask all the schools in the area. We were like big into like NWA, Public Enemy, all that sort of stuff.
There you go, exactly.
And what's been good recently is that new Netflix series about Michael Jordan's come out, and it's sort of like,
I need to watch this.
Yeah, it's starting to bring back all those memories of being at school. And begging my mum for a pair of Air Jordans and her telling me to fuck off because they're too expensive.
No, exactly. All those type of genres and those type of music and sort of like the crews and the culture, it's sad because I feel like it's not existent anymore. And I'm in the music industry, and it's something that heavily frustrates me. I think we're one of the few that are left that are sort of got that culture, got that band, and come from a real, real place. But yeah, I hope it comes back. I don't know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, hopefully. We'll see. Keep it going. Mate, How long has Rudimental been going on for, and what's your journey with them been? How did it all formulate? How did it come to fruition?
Yeah, so it's a bit of a bromance story, to be honest with you. I mentioned it a bit earlier where, you know, we grew up when we was like 5 years old. I first met Piers in infants and he had long hair. Like, he got mistaken for a girl. I remember a guy trying to kiss him once at 5 years old. and that was my introduction to Piers, because I had to break him up. I was like, no. He's a guy. And then I met Kezzy later on from then. And it was actually us three together, Kezzy, Piers and myself. And we grew up listening to music, and we started making music around about 12 years old, 13 years old. Piers, his dad was a musician, and he used to go around to pubs all over the UK and just play out with his band. And he had this makeshift studio in his house. And we used to go over there and we used to make beats and whatnot. And I used to have my decks in my house, and all the local boys, MCs, would come to my house, and they used to call it the basement. I used to have like 20 MCs in my bedroom. It was about the size of this room here. It was just like heaving, and they'll be rapping and we'll be DJing, playing some of our songs. And it was just like a good vibe. And that's where it kind of stemmed from, that kind of pirate radio station culture. We eventually got onto one of the pirate radio stations. It was called Deja Vu. And that was like one of the biggest pirate radio stations alongside Rinse FM at the time. And it had Wiley, Dizzy Rascal, Nasty Crew, like you name it, they were on it. And it was just like a big thing for us to be on there. And people didn't quite get us because we were so eclectic, but at the same time, our numbers were great. The listenership was great. And we kept like making music, and our music was doing well in the underground scene. And, you know, you're constantly just waiting for something to connect, and it didn't connect for a long time. I remember when we were about 18, 19, I was still working a 9-to-5 as a learning mentor in a secondary school, playing semi-professional football and spending all my nights in the studio making music, and, you know, just with the boys. And, you know, it wasn't until we made a track, I remember I mentioned Pembury Estate. We were in Pembury Estate. Kezzy came to live with me there and created a song called Field of Love. Made that song. We were singing on it. And I remember taking it to the studio with the rest of the boys, and like we were going nuts, crazy, just tearing off our clothes, trashing the place. We was like, this is a hit. This is the track that's going to make us. It's going to be crazy. And then we left that track in the studio for 2 years. Like, you know, you just had those moments where it's like, oh, this is amazing, crazy. And then it just, that moment's gone because no one's picked up, no one's heard it. And it stayed in the hard drive for 2 years. And let's fast forward 2 years later from that moment, we ended up in a pub and we could hear this guy singing. And because like we've grown up with each other pretty much all our lives, we're so in tune with each other. When we hear music, we often like the same music. And if we don't, we convince each other why we should like it. And we end up on the same path. And we heard this voice in the background. And we all just like stopped drinking for a minute, looked at each other, and we said, you know that track we made like a couple years ago? This guy was sounding sick on it. And behind us, it was John Newman. And it was like, we got him over as soon as he stopped playing. He had a guitar. He was doing like a little acoustic session. He was like, look, mate, we need to get you in the studio. We've got a perfect track for you. And then you fast forward like another few years. We ended up meeting Amir, the fourth and final member of the band. And Field of Love got heard by all the record labels, and it started traveling around like wildfire. And everyone wanted a piece of us. And yeah, the rest is history. So I'll say for me to get to this point now, probably about 2 decades. And no one really sees that. From the success we've had from our first track, probably about 10 years.
Yeah. So was it 10 years ago?
It's
crikey, yeah. Maybe.
Yeah, it's about eight years, but 10 years ago from the finished product of Field of Love. And yeah, so yeah. Nearly a decade ago, man. How Time Flies.
It is a monumental track, though, isn't it?
Like, I don't get me wrong. I can't listen to it in a car. Can't listen to it at home. It does my fucking nothing. But when I get on stage and like I'm playing in front of thousands of people and that song comes up, I've just got nothing but respect for the song. I know I'm like in third person mode, but mate, the song, without it, I wouldn't be here. You know what I mean? Talking to you.
Yeah. Mate, that's been quite a bit of a nostalgic chat there for myself as well, especially when you were talking about the early days of your music career with the pirate radios and that. And I'm not advocating pirate radio stations, by the way, but I used to love the there was one down in Luton called Power FM, and I think Power it was Power FM, and I think it was like, I think it used to get pumped out of a flat in an estate called the Marsh Farm Estate, and I could be wrong there. But I remember listening to it as a kid.
It sounds about right, mate.
Yeah, it's also you used to listen to the radio, the quality wasn't too good, but you used to like every now and again on the odd weekend you'd hear them getting raided and stuff.
That's what I'm saying. And it's just those kind of moments that just make it so magical, because like we didn't have internet back then, or if you did have internet, it was like really slow dial up. It didn't matter if you had it or not. So the only way you heard about sort of like new raves to go to, new music, was through radio. And I remember my first radio station that I ever went on to, again, it was a pirate radio station. It was in a flat, an abandoned flat that squatters were living in. And it had mattresses all around the walls to try and suppress the sound from going outside. And that's where Rudimental kind of stemmed from.
A flat decorated in mattress.
Yeah, exactly.
But mate, what is it like when you're on stage live, and like those moments, especially with, you know, banging out those massive tracks? What does it feel like? I'd love to know what it's like.
Mate, it's an out of body experience. It's one that I probably couldn't describe with enough adjectives or give it justification. It's so hard to describe. When you're there and you see a sea of people singing along to your songs, you've got nothing but goosebumps. But then you've got to realize, wait a minute, I'm here to put on a show as well. So I was talking to the rest of the boys about it. I was just like, why is it when we're on stage and, you know, our shows are going perfectly fine, and it's just like a great show, probably some of our best shows, and I can't remember what's happened? Like, I get off stage and I literally can't remember what's happened. However, when we go on stage and something goes wrong or something negative happens on stage, I come off stage after the show and I remember everything, literally everything, from what I ate that day to what it was like on stage from the minute we left. And I think that's a bit what it's like. When people ask that question that you've just asked, you're probably trying to remember the best show that you've ever done. But it's so difficult to remember because it's an out-of-body experience, and it's just like you're floating.
What are there any funny things that have gone wrong?
mate, how much time do you have?
let's just pick one or two.
I remember the early stages, you know, when we didn't really have enough money to take out a live band, because what you got to remember, Rudimental, we don't sing. We write our own music and then we go out and we look for singers. So on a live show, we have to get singers in, and we have to get like other musicians as well to play instruments that we can't play. For example, brass section, drummers and whatnot. So it costs a lot of money. So in the first initial stages, we didn't have a drummer because we was like, you know what? We're going to cut that cost because that's going to be a lot to travel all over the UK and the world. We'll have some of the drums playing out a backing track. We'll use a computer to play the drums coming out, and we will play our instruments on top of it. Now, you've heard a Rudimental track, and I'm sure there's a lot of people listening have heard a Rudimental track. Our music heavily relies on the drums, you know, the build-up, the euphoria of like the bass and whatnot coming in. So I remember we had a show in Bristol, and I think we were supporting Maverick Sabre at the time. And, you know, you've got all the musical elements of it. You've got us on our keys and whatnot, and you've got a bit of the brass section playing what they're playing. And you could imagine Feel the Love building up into sort of like the chorus, the big drop bit, and you got none of the drums came.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out of pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
And the computer completely failed on us. So we've got these big drops and like there's no drums whatsoever. So you could imagine me on stage going nuts with a mic in my hand going, yeah, let's go. And then bam, it's like we're doing acoustics of bloody all our tracks. And you're thinking, oh, it's just got to be that one track. So it's that one track that does it. And then the next track that does it. And the third track that does it. And you're like, oh my God, this is an absolute nightmare. And I'm looking at the crowd, and the thing is, the crowd are like looking at you as if to say, what is going on? I like it, but I don't know what it is. And I remember coming off stage, and I back then I used to have a massive temper. I literally just trashed like the whole changing room. And I remember looking back at tweets, and everyone was like, oh, absolutely love the show, but why were they doing an acoustic version of all their tracks? It was a fucking nightmare.
Oh, mate, I can imagine I'd lose my shit on that stuff. Yeah. It's all those things like that I just, does my head in. Mate, do you like being on tour?
Oh, I got a love-hate relationship with tour, you know. I love the fact that I get to see so many different places, so many different countries, so many different cultures, people, and play in front of some amazing crowds, you know. Like, I've gone to some places that even if I did have enough money, I know myself, I probably wouldn't travel as much as I have done or had the luxury of doing with Rudimental. And that side of it is amazing. But I'm a very homely person, you know. I get homesick very quickly. I miss my boy tremendously, as a lot of people have seen on SAS Who Dares Wins. So that has some strain on me. I can remember one incident where we was touring with Ed Sheeran in America, and we were supporting him, and it was an amazing tour, but it literally went on for 2.5 months.
Wow.
Just literally on the road. And you kind of lose a sense of reality when you're on the road, because sometimes you're like, you end up, I don't know, you're in LA and then you wake up and then you're in San Diego or something. It's just like, wow. You feel like you've been time traveling or something. You really ain't got a clue of where you are. And all those stresses were sort of like starting to take its toll. It started off good, but then started to take its toll. And I can't remember. In fact, I think it might have been LA, actually, we ended up. And I was just missing the family. Mm. And it's mad how the similarities are so similar to the tricks that you guys tried to do with us on SAS, with letting us have that video call with, you know, our family member, and how fucked up that can be when you're in a dark place, a million miles away from your family. And I remember receiving a call, FaceTime, with my boy, and you know, it was a great call, and I wish it wasn't, but it was a great call, and it just put me in a downward spiral. Went on stage, mumbling most of my words that I was saying on stage. It was a good show, luckily. And I remember David Beckham came after the show, and he was like, that was a great show. And I didn't even acknowledge him then, because that's how upset I was. You have those moments on tour. It's not as glamorous as it looks like. You don't often get to see the countries that you visit. You know, you're living in and out of hotel rooms and tour buses and airports. And I think airport security is the one that winds me up the most. It's because you do it so many times within one day or one week or a month. It's just like taking out the same shit all the time. It's just Groundhog Day.
It sucks up so much time, doesn't it? There's an old story about Ian Wright when he used to play at West Ham. I don't know him, but obviously being a gooner.
Of course.
But there was one when he was playing for West Ham in the early days, and he got sent off, didn't he? Apparently,
yeah.
And he said he walked up the tunnel. He's like, "Fuck this, I'm going." And then he just sort of suddenly stopped, looked to one side, and there was the referee's changing room. apparently, the way he tells the story, I've seen it on telly, he just couldn't remember anything else after that. But apart from when he got home, Harry Redknapp's phoning him up going, "What the f***? get your ass back here now." Anyway, yeah, that's what your little dip there about Ed Sheeran reminded me of.
Definitely. You had these blackouts, mate.
Probably one of the biggest parts of your life, I know it's a part that you're probably the most proud of, is when you first became a dad.
Yeah.
How did that change Locksmith?
It changed me massively. I got a tattoo on my arm that says Leonidas is my savior, because I truly believe that the guy you're speaking to now is not the guy who was running around the streets of Hackney, getting up to no good, getting into scraps every weekend, and I literally mean every weekend. That I'm not that guy anymore, but that's the guy I was before Leonidas was born. And he gave me a sense of responsibility that I massively needed. I truly believe he saved my life, and without him, I don't think I would have got past 25 without probably being dead or in prison somehow, and you have these moments in your life where you're just grateful that, either somebody or a role model or, a son or a daughter comes into your life and helps change you for the better. I noticed things like my temper, my patience, that all simmering down rather. And I was able to sort of like not let the stresses of the world get to me as much as they did before he was born. It was tough because I was 23 when he was born. I had about 100 quid left in my pocket before we got signed. Field of Love got signed, and I didn't really know how I was going to do it, but I knew that I was going to do it. And yeah, thankfully he helped me get to where I am now.
Awesome. Did it like happen overnight? That change in your approach to life,
mate. The moment your missus is pregnant and she's telling you to run downstairs, one of the worst estates in the world, to go to the off licenses to pick up Vinetta, the ice cream, because that's her bloody, what do they call it when they're pregnant?
The craving.
Yeah, that's a craving. And you're having to do shit like that. And, you have to start doing selfless acts. It's from that moment you start realizing, wait, this is changing me instantly. And then when you're in the hospital and the baby comes, I think it is an instant thing. You're looking into the eyes of the baby. I know it sounds soppy, but it is what it is. I cried and I was just like, I'm going to do everything in my power to, give you the best possible chance at life. And that just changed me instantly.
Mm. Awesome. And now you got another one.
Yeah. Baby girl. I think I'm done.
Mixing it up.
Yeah, she's gorgeous. She's going to be a bit of a diva, but she's a good one.
Awesome, mate. Let's start. Let's get on to the thing you've just finished. The thing you've just won. People say won. We like to say finishes.
Sounds better.
Finishes, because it is an achievement to do that. Mate, how did you... how did you get into it? How did you get convinced or find out that you were going to be able to get on to SAS Who Dares Wins?
I've always had this element of me that wanted to push myself beyond my boundaries, beyond my limits. And when I found out that, you know, I could be possibly going on the show, I was like, I have to jump at this. I have to, definitely. It's right up my street. And the funny thing about sort of like TV and me being in my position, I turn down every TV opportunity, literally. I don't do any TV or any reality side of TV or all those kind of shows. I was just like, fuck that, I'm not getting involved in that. But when this came knocking at my door, I was like, I have to do this. This is everything that I feel inside of me, I'll be more than capable of doing it. Although when on the first fucking day that we were there, on the hour, I was like, what the fuck have I got myself into? I don't know if I'm capable. I don't know what I was thinking. But I remember like being about 16, 17 and, you know, I was at college. Football wasn't doing what I wanted it to do, or I wasn't making it. And I said to myself, look, if I don't make it as a footballer, I'm going to go to the army. And, you know, you have them open days at college where sort of like the army come in, they try and recruit as many youngsters as they possibly can. I was like, I took all the forms. I was ready to sign away. I was like, yep, I want that team feeling, because I was always craving for something higher. Like, you know, that craving was inside of me. And I was ready to hand in forms. Like, and then I fell in love and we ended up having two kids together. And that kind of steered my path elsewhere and my direction after Leonidas was born. You know, I didn't feel that craving to, you know, for that higher purpose. Mm. But yeah, when SAS came knocking on my door, and I remember, I think I did soccer. Yeah, I did. I did soccer aid with Ant, played against him.
Yeah.
And I don't think I mentioned it to him once, to be fair. I didn't say that I wanted to be on the show because I don't really watch TV. I've heard of the show and I was like, this show is sick. I need to sit down and watch it. And I never actually watched it. And I'm thankful I didn't watch it, because if I did, I probably would have said, fuck that again. I'm not doing that. But I think as soon as the opportunity arisen, I was like, yeah, definitely jumping at it. So I'm forever grateful for you guys, for everything that you've given us on the show. Because some people don't realize it. I think a lot of people see it and they're like, oh, that's too brutal. Why are they treating them this way? And correct me if I'm wrong, Foxy, but I feel like there's a purpose for everything you guys do on the show, you know, and the whole sort of breaking you down to the point where you feel like you can't go any further, and then reaching and digging deeper for that extra 10%, 15%, whatever it is what the show is all about, you know?
Yeah. There's a lot of, yeah, mate, I really appreciate that, because there is a, you know, there is a lot of sort of, there's opinions that, you know, it's just a load of lads being nasty, but it's not. Yeah. It's like you've got it is about self-development, I think, and it's about,
definitely,
you've got to break it down right to some really gritty places, you know, you've got to go to some sort of dark places to then really find out who you are and how you can deal with sticky situations. And it's about becoming comfortable with the uncomfortable, isn't it, really?
Yeah, yeah.
And that means that we have to act in a way that makes people feel uncomfortable. So there's a reason for everything. There always is. There's always a reason.
100%. And you know what? Like, with lockdown now, like in full sort of session, a lot of people are gonna find out a lot about themselves that they never knew, you know, existed. You know, they're going to have to look in the mirror every day and see themselves, spend time with themselves. Mm. You can stare at, you know, your social media all day and pretend to live in that reality. But with lockdown and not having that accessibility to socialize with everyone else, they're going to be faced with themselves. And it's going to be interesting to see how we get out of it the other side. And
it is going to be an interesting. Mm. It's going to be interesting to see the landscape. I was actually going on to a bit of the behind the scenes stuff with SAS.
All right.
I chatted to Helen Skelton.
Oh yeah.
I think it was yesterday. And she did mention that you are probably the loudest person when it comes to farting. She said not only can Rudimental and Lockie knock out tunes, he can knock out tunes on his own.
All right, mate, episode 5, God knows why you lot kept that in, but I love you for it. The whole farting on Tony's head, that was hilarious.
Mate, that was awesome. Wasn't it when you were falling onto the... It was on E&E, wasn't it? It was on the escape and evasion.
It was hilarious, man. And that, you know what? The audience probably got about 10% of Tony's reaction. Because he went off on one.
Surprise, surprise.
Yeah. Bless him. Love Tone.
Mate, I know what the answer to this one's going to be, but I'm going to ask you for the benefit of the others. Go into this a little bit, because...
Go on.
You know, a lot of people are like, oh, do you all have a laugh when the cameras are off? You know, does it just cut and then you just have a bit of a crack and what have you? You know, bring that to life.
Mate, I've been on TV sets and behind the scenes of some reality TV shows, and you're on there and, you know, there's people waiting for you hand and foot with cup of tea, you know, a wet towel, you know, a little wet wipe to wipe your ass if you need to be. And it's so far from that when you jump onto the SAS Who Dares Wins. Soon as you enter, not even the day where you start doing your missions or your activities, just the day before, there's someone there with an envelope, and they're not the nicest looking person. They tell you to put your phone in there, put all your electricals in there, and you're not allowed to, you know, have any contact with the outside world. And then you get into the facility, and you know, you got the cameramen that are about, and none of them are allowed to talk to you. None of them talk to you. Like you're just gagging for a bit of the outside world interaction, and no one's talking to you, and no one's like communicating with you or giving you any sympathy or any love whatsoever. In fact, there was one incident where the audio guys came to change our packs, and it was me and Tony. I don't know if you guys probably saw this on camera, but if you get to see it, please.
No, I know what you're going to talk about. Carry on.
Yeah, we all get asked to line up, and the audio guy wasn't the nicest looking guy. He was grim as fuck, and he literally told us, he said, turn around, put your arms up, quiet. And it's just like, everything's just so direct and forceful. And you got to remember, we've probably just been climbing up mountains, done 10Ks, 5Ks, jumping out of helicopters, freezing cold, you know, all this shit. And then you got someone who's changing your pack. And I remember Tony being like, it'd be all right if you had some fucking manners. And like, just literally went into him, like just ripped him a new one. And the audio guy just literally, all the white just came into his face. But that's what it's like. There was no sympathy. There was no one waiting on hand and foot for you.
They're very professional. I've got to let you into a secret here. So that guy,
yeah,
I know who it is. It's a bloke called Sam, and he's basically. I've explained this before, but he's basically the floor manager. He's been doing it for quite a while. So he normally interacts with us. He comes in.
Yeah.
When he comes into our dormitory, and I tell you what, for the last, I think he's been with us for 3 years. We absolutely annihilate him. Like, honestly, he literally walks in so despondent, and we're like that, what the fuck? You know, just hurling abuse at him. We have a bit of a laugh with him, and you know, he's on constant receive. He's just on, anyway. He came back in one day. It was that day, and he was like, he goes, oh my God. He goes, I need protection. He goes, hell, he hates me. He goes, he's gunning for me. He goes, but I'm not allowed to talk to them. I've got to be really strict, because that's what the bosses say. And we're like, get back in there. And he's just like, I can't. He's like, I don't want to see Tony Bellew again.
Oh, I'm in stitches, mate. It, I swear to you, Tony looked like he was about to just fling him up against the wall. And I was angry as well, because, you know, we've been through shit. And but you know, Tony, man. It was hilarious, man. Afterwards, I was just laughing.
Mate, that spread like wildfire through the crew. The crew were like, Sam's going to get battered by Bellew.
I love that.
Yeah, quality. You still in touch with everyone from it? As in,
totally, man. I'm not trying to, you know, sugarcoat it. Like, the guys were amazing on there. And that was one of my biggest fears. And, you know, you get asked that question, what was your biggest fear before going on? And for me, it was the heights. I can't deny that massively. I'm scared of heights. And probably scared of standing up on a chair too high. You know what I mean? Like, I am.
Mate, I feel your pain on that.
Yeah, I know you do, mate. But another one, not my fear, but just something I was really worried about was the whole social interaction with other people I don't know and not being able to get away from them. And I'm a recluse when I'm at home. At most, I see the rudimental boys and then I come home and I get on with life that way. So that was a bit of a worry for me. And outside of, like, you know, football teams and all that kind of stuff, that was a worry for me. But they were amazing. You know, every single one of them, even Fash, put me in a headlock on that day. he was still a good lad and everyone had each other's back. So we've got WhatsApp groups. I talk on the phone to Tony daily. Like, clearly one of the recruits that I got on with the most. Love him to pieces. We talk a lot, man.
Awesome. Has it helped you in any way understand yourself? Has it been beneficial?
Oh, mate, without a doubt. And that's why I'm so thankful for you guys and what you do. Not just for having me on the show, and people could say, oh, you're on the show because it does this to your profile. I couldn't give two shits about that. For me, it was about myself. Like, I needed to find out how far I could be pushed. And I didn't actually understand. I didn't think I had any issues, deep rooted issues, until I went on the show. And, you know, you get stripped bare. You physically feel like you can't go on anymore, and you just question yourself all the time. And then the issues with my dad, that sort of came to the surface, and it started making me realize, especially in my early days, and like more towards, you know, maybe a year before going on SAS, I was starting to drift back into sort of how I was when I was younger, losing my temper and, you know, just really going off on one and not wanting to be in the music industry anymore. I wanted to quit. I didn't want to just faff about with all these snobs and the hierarchies that be. Getting into the SAS and coming out the other side made me learn how to not take things on board too heavily and carry that weight around with you all the time, and how you've got to distribute that not only on yourself but with the people that are close with you. Talk more. You know, those kind of things.
Yeah, definitely. Communicate. Just quickly, still on SAS.
Yeah.
Mate, episode 5, it was brutal, but you put in a massive shift. And yeah. How is the knee?
The knee's cool, man. The knee's good. Like, just to set the record straight with everyone out there, it was a long-term knee injury that I've had for years. However, you know, I didn't want to go down the surgery route. I wanted to put that off for as long as I could, because I still believe I'm going to be a professional footballer at some point. I'm able to maintain it. And you guys gave me all the tools that I needed to maintain that. You got, like, you allowed me to have my foam roller in. The doctor was on hand and foot if I had any issues, had a knee bracket as well. But it was just a case of, it was just the uphill and going downhill. And it was just one point, I just felt it. And it was just like, mate, it was horrific. But I managed to get through it. And the knee's fine now. Like, I'm doing 10K runs all day, every day. So, nice. Yeah, I'm in a good place.
Yeah, I mean, that canoe's difficult to carry. But
how you lot do that? You lot are nutters. I don't get it.
the trail was, we picked, I mean, even me and Ollie, we were leading it. That trail was pretty... It was tricky, yeah.
Yeah.
No, but, mate, because of that experience, I mean, I don't know how much you did before, but are you going to continue doing stuff in the great outdoors?
Mate, before this, I you wouldn't catch me camping, going up mountains, nothing. I'm a proper inner city boy. And after doing this show, I've just got a craving to just be up on a mountain, like, test my limits as much as I possibly can. And I definitely want to get outside more. And that's something I probably deprived from my boy And I'm glad that I've done the show, because now I've got that kind of insight into it that I want to share with him, because it just opens your mind up. And it's the sense of freedom as well, man.
Yeah, there is a big sense of freedom. Mate, when it all goes back to normal, maybe we should get a little mini expedition around the UK in with your lad.
No, you're all right, mate. I'm not coming nowhere near you.
Mate, we get listeners to send in question requests, and there's always loads that come through. There's been a lot that's come through for you. I'm going to keep it lighthearted, to be honest, and I'm going to ask you. This is from Victor_Saki30, and it is, what's the food you get served like? What's the worst thing they fed you on the show? So not on tour, because I'm sure you get lashed right up. On SAS, Who Dares Wins, what was the worst thing that we gave you?
No, you know what? I think it's just got to be the dry rice. Like, the rice was just horrific. It was so dry, so mundane. It was like
boring.
Yeah, sandpaper in your mouth, really. So yeah, that's the answer to that one.
There wasn't, if I'm honest, there isn't an awful lot that they get given, to be fair. Yeah, it's pretty,
I could imagine,
pretty bog standard. I mean, there was some chickens there. Obviously, you see Joey Essex having a little bit of a,
yeah,
bit of a thing. Obviously, Victor_Saki30 is going to be receiving a bottle of Talisker single malt 10-year whiskey. And I think we're going to be running that again as we keep going on throughout this series. So nice one, Victor.
Sick. Well done, Victor.
When everything goes back to normal, what have you got on? What's coming up? What's on the horizon?
Well, yeah, obviously everyone's in the same situation right now in terms of, you know, their shows or their work has been put on hold. So everything will be pushed back until next year, we hope, fingers crossed. So yeah, we're going to have loads more shows. We're also thinking about releasing another album at some point. I don't think it'll be this side of the year, hopefully next year, because, you know, we're at home. We've all got home studios in our gaffs, luckily fortunate enough to have that. So we're able to continue to work. So we're continuously making music every other day. So hopefully a new album next year, some more touring. And I've also got some stuff that I'm doing on my own on the locksmith side of stuff. I'm bringing out a gym clothing brand. Well, it's out now. I think I've sent you a 10kg vest that should be in the post here.
Yeah, looking forward to that.
Mate, it's all inspired by you guys, you know, and it literally is. So yeah, all that gear is going to be available. Well, it's available right now.
Okay, so if anyone's interested, where can they find it?
Yeah, check out my website, theycallmelocksmith.com. It's me. I've got 10kg weighted tactical vest, foam rollers, and we've got some hats. There's going to be some tracksuits coming soon, t-shirts, gym equipment that you'd expect. But yeah, it's all coming from me, and all the designs and everything is me. It's actually doing my nutting how much hard work this is. I didn't think it would be this hard starting from the ground up, but it is. And it's really good to see people wearing my bits.
Awesome. So wrapping it up, mate, because it's been a bit of time now and I know you've got kids and everything.
Oh, good.
So what's the best thing about what you do? What gets you buzzing in the day?
Oh, in terms of work or just in general?
Do both of them.
Yeah, in terms of work, I think it's the ability to make a difference in people's lives, you know, and that's something I've always wanted to do. I wanted to inspire and motivate people off the back of, like you mentioned, Ian Wright. He's my biggest inspiration of all time. You know, I've watched Ian Wright come from where he's come from and make it against the odds. You know, he made me feel like you could achieve the impossible. And that's what I've always wanted to make people feel like. And I've managed to do that through my music. And every time I make a song or we make a song, I feel like that's my happiest moment, you know, and getting that out for people. Yeah. Because you've got songs like Not Giving In. I've heard so many stories of how that's helped people get through so many negative scenarios in their lives. And then you've got people who just want to go out, and we're able to cater for that.
Cater for it all.
Yeah, definitely.
Mate, that is awesome. I'd just like to wrap it up now. So,
cool, man.
Lockie, you are a legend. I appreciate you coming on. I've watched you dig deep and deliver day after day after day on SAS Who Dares
Wins. Thank you, man.
And truly appreciate that. You deserve to be there at the end with Lauren. So,
mate, thank you.
That was a solid effort, and I hope we can stay mates and catch up when this is all over.
We'll be best friends.
nice one, mate.
Foxy, man.
Wicked. Mate, take it easy. Awesome.
You too.
Thanks very much to Locksmith. I hope you enjoyed it. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast if you don't already, and follow me and the Book of Man for the latest news. Thanks again to Talisker for supporting this podcast, and thank you all for listening. Take care, and we'll see you soon.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.